This is the Decibel Geek Podcast with Chris Sinzak and Aaron Camaro.
I know you've been waiting, and here we are, time once again for the Decibel Geek Podcast. My name is Aaron Camaro, and I'm joined, as always, by my kick-ass, awesome friend and co-host, Chris Sinzak. What's going on, brother? We're back.
Yeah, how you doing?
Just feeling good. You know, we've been on a roll lately with the show. We've been having a lot of fun and putting out some really good episodes, but I'm feeling like we need to do an interview. Man, it's been too long since we've done an interview, so I said, Chris, man, you got to find us somebody, and man, did you come through.
Yeah, through the power of Facebook.
Gotta love it.
So, yeah, so we have Mike Fraser joining us this week, and if you don't know his name, you definitely know his work, because his resume is a mile long and filled with tons of records from 1980 all the way through today that you've probably listened to, notably 5 different AC/DC records and tons of great stuff, including Blue Murder, Aerosmith, Permanent Vacation, and Pump, and Metallica, and tons of stuff. And we're going to get all into it here in just a few minutes.
Man, so many awesome albums. I mean, man, we missed out on some stuff.
easily.
There's only so much time. And I mean, if you need to, take a moment, pause this, and look up his discography. Look at everything that he's had his hand in from the year 1980 all the way up to 2020, and you're going to be pretty amazed and understand why we couldn't cover everything. But rest assured, we are the Decibel Geek Podcast, so we definitely covered the rock and roll, and we're going to have an amazing conversation today with Mike Fraser. But you know us, before we get to all that, we got to take care of our business, and our business, well, we love them. They're reviews and recommendations, Podchaser, Apple Podcast reviews, Facebook recommendations, however you want to give them to us, we'll take them because we love them, and it really does help the show a lot when it comes to other people finding a show like ours, because that's what they're looking for. So a review like this really helps. This one comes to us from Inga Lizard. Oh, a recent guest on Beat the Geek, I think. Yep, it makes sense because it's titled, I'm a Jerk. And there's 5 stars, and it goes like this. I've been listening to these guys since about episode 10 and wow, have failed to write a review. Always at the top of my podcast list. Albums Unleashed of Wild America, Slave to the Grind, and Motley Crue 94. Are you kidding me? Killer. Great interviews, Beat the Geek, New Noise, Camaro's Cutouts, and I just want to thank you guys. I appreciate what you do. Rock on. Awesome. Brett told us he was going to leave us a review. After almost 9 years, he's finally come through for us, but he did it in a big way. Thank you, man.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Very cool. Now, we had a lot of fun last week, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
Yep, we tried out something new, and people seem to dig it. Brush with Greatness. We talked to Jeff Cecil, we talked to Richie Rivera, and we talked to Dave Tedder, and we got cool stories about Dokken, about Alice in Chains, and Rick James. Man,
oh, yes.
What a great story that was.
That's going to be a hard one to top.
But the cool thing is you guys followed instructions and you made us a list. When last week's episode was posted on Facebook, you added your names to it. So next time we do this again, we're going to pull up that post and look. And I already seen some on there. You met Alice Cooper at Home Depot. I want to hear that story.
Yeah, I know Alice was shopping for a circular saw, apparently.
Wow. Stage prop, maybe.
But yeah, thank you guys for all the feedback, and so you might wind up on the show for sure.
Yeah, I like that. I like talking to the listeners, and I like when listeners help by giving us questions to ask our guests, because yes, you know what? We've proved over the years we can do a pretty damn good interview, but I really like it because you guys can contribute to Decibel Geek, because this show always has been and always will be about you, the listener. So thank you to everybody that contributed questions for today. And thank you to everybody that shared last week's episode, because they are Geeks of the Week.
Geeks of the Week this week are Rockin' Ron Runyon, Samuel Wetz, Bach, Oak Overs and Fire Podcast, Bill Elam, Matt Ashcraft, Eric Senzak, that's my brother, Richie Rivera, the man himself, Scott Crouch, David Cathy, Adam Cox, Mike Parnell, Joseph Capone, Christopher Stokes, Simon Gatt, Mikhail Burrell, Craig Turdich, Patrick Breen, Rob Harris, Paul Smith, Grayson Gallegos, Jeffrey Mendenhall, David Glenn, Paul Korn, Andrew Jacobs, Aaron Baker, Doug Fox, JJP, Body of the Soul, Eladio, Hakon Bergstad, Jeff Taylor, Stickman, Alan DeShaunt, Ernesto Aguiar, Vet Halen, the Alternate Route Podcast, Focus on Metal Podcast, Nick Minow, and as always,
the Mooger Fooger. That's right. Those are our people. Why? Because they went out and shared and retweeted last week's episode, which is really awesome because what these people are doing is they're sharing what we're doing with all their people, and all their people go, wow, that's really cool. I need to check that out. And so we grow the community, and that means more people talking over on the Facebook page, which Coxie is running real well for us. And then we got more people tuning in to Decibel Geek TV, where Rockin' Ron is adding all the episodes and has a awesome backlog of live entertainment and kick-ass bands going on over there. You want to get yourself a Decibel Geek t-shirt, you got to check us out at clicktees.shop.com. You're going to love all the cool stuff they got going on over there, not just podcasts like us, but Kiss-inspired stuff and all kinds of cool things. Go to clicktees.shop.com, get yourself a Decibel Geek t-shirt and something else, too. What else? I'm excited. I'm ready to talk to the man.
Yeah, here's our talk with Mike Fraser. Your credits listing is pretty insane. I mean, you've really worked on tons of stuff going back to the early 80s that Aaron and I both, you know, grew up listening to and some of our favorite records. So a very prolific career. And I know obviously this is kind of a getting to know you episode. So we definitely want to have you back in the future to kind of maybe break down a particular album, you know, track by track.
Yeah, sure. Okay. That sounds like fun, too.
Yeah, okay. For sure. You got a resume that's like a mile long, just full of amazing stuff, pieces of rock and roll history. And, I mean, I guess to start, I mean, a lot of our listeners, we've got listeners that are, you know, musicians that have done very well for themselves. And we've got listeners that are kind of like me, they're just fans of rock music. So for you, somebody that's done all three, could you break it down in the simplest terms, the difference between a producer, an engineer, and a mixer?
All right. Well, a producer is kind of the captain of the ship, if you would. And in the music industry, as I guess a lot of your listeners would know, producer is kind of like the director of a film. So he's directing things. You know, he's kind of liaisons with the band, make sure they have the songs written that they want to do. Some producers help a lot with the writing or co-writing of the songs. So he's got the bigger picture with what the band wants and where the direction the producer wants to take them to achieve those goals. So the engineer is the guy that's, you know, fiddles all the knobs and gets the sounds and captures the band out in the studio. And if you liken that to the movie industry, the engineer is like the cameraman. So he's capturing everything according to sort of the producer's directives. And, you know, when you work a lot with the same producers, you become a team. So those lines kind of get blurred, you know, as an engineer, you know, experienced engineer. You know, I can pipe in and say, hey, how about if we try this? Or, hey, let's do that. And you're not walking on the producer's, you know, toes or anything.
Right.
And then a mixer is basically the same as an engineer, but the mixer is the guy that takes all the colors that you've recorded, all the guitars, drums, vocals, everything, and the mixer blends it all in together into what you guys hear as the final product. So you try and really make sure that painting comes out and sparkles and does everything that song is supposed to do. You know, as a mixer, you still got to think of what the song is. It doesn't matter what instruments is there. What's the core of the song? And some songs are very sort of vocal driven. So the instruments have to be more of a background, holding that those vocals up. Some are more, you know, riff orientated, so those got to be louder. The vocals are just lyrics over top of that. You know, I mean, there's different perspectives. So the mixer's responsibility is to find what he feels is the perspective of the song, and then hopefully the producer and the band agree with it.
Nice.
So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Right.
Well, you, yeah, so, like, you know, just going through your credits, going, you know, at the beginning, like, and I saw another interview with you with the Australian fellow on YouTube, and, you know, you kind of went through your story about how, you know, you took a janitor job at Little Mountain to kind of get your foot in the door over there, and that's, that place is so historically amazing because, you know, so many amazing records came out, but also you and Bruce Fairbairn and Bob Rock all came out of that place, so, that the early days of that, and it says the first thing on your credits list is the Prism record, Young and Restless. What was it like at those early days of kind of, you know, earning your keep and getting your foot in the door? Was it a slog to get, you know, kind of get your foot in the door and gain respect among the other people working there?
It didn't seem like it. You know, I was young. I think I was 18 when I started there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was just such a thrill to be working at a studio. You know, it was a pain in the butt to drive that hour in the morning and start at 5 a.m. to do my janitor duties. But, you know, hey, it was awesome. And then sometimes I'd show up there at 5 a.m. and some of the other rooms were still had people left over from the night before, just kind of finishing up, and ashtrays just piled with ashes and smoke lingering and all that stuff. And then during the day, the studio at the time was primarily a jingle house. So that was the owners and most of the staff there were, that's what they do. So they'd record jingles all day, and basically the doors kind of got locked at 5 or 6 o'clock. So after my janitor duties, you know, about 8 or 9 o'clock, then I'd start helping some of the engineers setting up microphones and stuff, getting ready for the jingle duty. So then I'd sort of learn, you know, what different microphones were, watch these guys record jingles. And so at the time, Bob Rock was an assistant engineer. So he was, you know, working a lot of these too. And at night, he would come in and be recording a lot of the Vancouver punk rock band. So he'd, you know, come in after 6 or 7 because he could get free studio time because it was shut down anyways. So I said, hey, you know, mind if I come in and give you a hand at night? And he says, ah, sure, if you're into it. So I did that for a while, probably about 1.5 years. So because of my hours, I had to sleep in a sleeping bag in the loading bay.
Wow.
Because I had to do my janitor from 5 to 9, the jingle stuff from 9 to 6, and then Bob and I would hang out there till 2 or 3 in the morning. So that's how we got going. And then Bruce Fairbairn was floating around. So the first record Bob and Bruce did was together was one called Armageddon with Prism. And that was one of Bruce's first productions, one of Bob's first engineering jobs. And I was still janitoring, so I'd pop in and help out, but I didn't get the like an assistant credit on that. But it was quickly after that, me and Bob and Bruce like formed a team because we just worked so good together. So that's really what started that nucleus. And, you know, with Bruce's talents and Bob's talents, you know, they started attracting better bands. Like, you know, the first sort of big one they did together was Loverboy. And then that did fairly good down the States. So got the attention of Jon Bon Jovi. And then that got the attention of Steven Tyler and Joe Perry. And, you know, it just kind of snowballed from there.
Yeah. So, well, you know, Bruce Fairbairn, you know, sadly passed away in the late 90s, I believe, that he passed.
Yeah.
So, like, really the internet hadn't taken off, and Bob Rock, you know, Bob Rock's been interviewed 1,000,000 times on 1,000,000 different things, so we kind of have a feel for what he was like as a person, but there's not a lot known about Bruce Fairbairn, like, as a person. Was he a taskmaster in the studio? Was he a laid-back guy? What kind of a guy was Bruce?
Well, he was a pretty laid-back guy, but he was very, like, super organized. You know, he was very easygoing, but, you know, he'd come in every morning or every, you know, start time. Totally knew exactly what he wanted to achieve that day and, you know, at what time. Like, you know, say okay, it's time to put a guitar solo on this song. We'd all set up and guy'd start playing. And if he was kind of writing his solo as he went, Bruce would kind of go with it. But, you know, when it got to a point of being, you know, an hour or two, Bruce says, look, go back to your room or the hotel or whatever. Come up with something there, and then let's do this tomorrow or later tonight. He says, we got to move on. So he always kept things moving. So I think Bruce was never over budget. I think he was always under budget on his records, money and time-wise. He just, you know, liked to keep things going. You know, he's totally into people getting creative and all that, but he didn't like wasting time. So he was very much a taskmaster, but done in a nice way, if you know what I mean.
Gotcha.
He's a super family guy, too. He'd come in, you know, we'd start usually about 11 or so. He'd come in, and then he'd go home at 5 to make dinner for the family. And then, you know, a couple times a week, he coached his son's soccer team. So sometimes he wouldn't come back till 8 or 9 at night. And, you know, so he'd give us tasks. Okay, well, I'm gone. Can you, you know, put together a vocal track or comp that guitar solo or, you know, something like that? So, you know, he always had us working, but he was very much – a great balance between home life and studio.
I'm still a little blown away that this all begins with the young producer, the young engineer, and the janitor.
Yeah, I know,
that's
right?
Awesome.
Well, you know, in a funny way, like Vancouver's, you know, basically such a young town. So, you know, we were competing with, you know, records being done in Toronto, New York, Nashville, Los Angeles, you know, all over the world. And being such a young town, we never had the big old radio stations that all the cool mics came from. We never had gear suppliers. So we're, you know, pretty much, we didn't really have much in the way of outboard gear. And I'm not sure we were really aware of that until, you know, we started competing with sort of the international artists and, you know, making our records kick ass just was a lot of work. And then if you'd go down to L.A. to, you know, do something in a studio there, you'd walk around with your jaw on the floor going, wow, look at all the stuff they got.
Yeah.
No wonder their records sound that like that. And, you know, we're always trying to think of tricks to how did they do that? Oh, maybe they, you know, shot a signal out to the loading bay and back here, and then little did we realize they had an echo chamber or something. You know what I mean?
So wow, yeah.
I think the three of us just worked really hard at what we had to do, and then that, I guess, just gelled us together to compete internationally without us even knowing it, you know?
Right.
That's awesome.
You mentioned Aerosmith with Permanent Vacation. So the three of you worked on that record. And which some people thought Done With Mirrors was the comeback record. But, I mean, Permanent Vacation was the one that kind of blew the doors off and really brought that band back. So. Yeah. When those guys were in there doing the record, I mean, they were not really kind of at a great point in their lives. Was it a happy time to make that record, or was there a lot of struggle to make that one?
Oh, it was a totally happy time. From what I remember, I think they were at that point 6 months sober.
Yeah.
They were just overjoyed, you know, and Bruce was a real easy guy to work with. He was always up and happy, and so there was never any heavy moments. And I remember, you know, Steven saying, hey, this is the first record we've ever done where I actually remember what we're doing on it. He says, you know, a lot of the past records, he says, we were just so wasted that, you know, we wouldn't really know what happened on the record till we got the record, the finished record. You know, he says sometimes he'd throw pillows down on the floor and I'd lie down on these pillows and they'd position a mic over me. And they said, well, when you hear music in your headphones, sing. When you don't hear anything, don't sing. So he says, it's just so great to be sober and part of this moment. So that they had a blast doing that record.
That's cool.
I bet. Yeah.
Oh, but yeah, we had we talked to Desmond Child a couple of years ago, and he talked about a little bit about the making of some of the songs on this one. And he mentioned there being a lot of strife between Steven Tyler and Joe Perry with the song Angel, because it was so outside the box for what Aerosmith had done before, and Joe was just not having it, and that he eventually got on board. Was any of the writing with Desmond done during that time, or was all that stuff done by the time you worked on it?
A lot of it was pre-done, I know, but I do know that while we'd be working on some songs, you know, they'd say, hey, we need another radio song or whatever, and there'd be writing going on in the background, you know, whether Diane Warren or Desmond Child or Jim Valance or whatever. So I never witnessed any of that. It was usually the writers, you know, would do it down in L.A. or wherever they were living, and it would be kind of FedExed back and forth because, again, there's no internet back then, so it was a slow mail. If they could take a weekend off, you know, Stephen and Joe would fly down or whatever, but any songwriting was done outside of the studio.
Right. Okay.
And Steven Tyler's listed as lead vocals, piano, harmonica, organ, and plunger mute. What the hell is a plunger mute?
Well, actually, Steven and I did those on one of the songs, and it's kind of a mouth percussion thing. It's sort of like a... So it ends up like hand claps, but it's just me and Steven going...
Wow.
I think we also got Flesh Bongos on there, too. But I'll let your imagination figure out what those are.
I don't know that I want to imagine what those are. Oh, man.
Something I was wondering, because I'm a big fan of Motley Crue. I'm a big fan of the Supersonic Demonic Relics album that came out. I think anytime one of my favorite bands releases an album of demos from back in their earlier days to be heard for the first time ever, I just love that stuff. And listening to that, there's some strange things on there, like Mood Ring. And I was wondering, with something like that, where it's like a re-release of unreleased music, do you get like a box of reels and they say, do the best you can with this, or how does that work?
Basically, they go through archives and they just pull out stuff that was mixed. You know, the records I've done with the AC/DCs, there was, you know, a few extra songs, but we would take them far because the band go, okay, if they're not good enough to finish and they're not going to make the record, then they just put them in the shelf. So there's not too many like that. But, you know, with Motley Crue, I'm sure they just, you know, always kept recording, and then do, you know, 16 songs and put 10 on the record and there's six left over. So I'm sure, you know, Tommy and then probably went through their vaults and said, hey, yeah, let's do this and let's throw that on there. And that's cool. And I guess I've never been involved with it. Okay. I've never had to go back and hey, let's mix these old demo tapes because usually they're already mixed at the point where the band let them go, you know. So
gotcha. Mm-hmm. I guess I thought I saw on your website that you had something to do with that album.
Well, I'm not. Is that the John Corabi record?
Yeah, that was the one. It had some of the Quaternary songs on there, and then it had a couple of weird old Crue songs with Vince Neil on them.
Yeah, you know what? All I remember on that record is
it's like '99.
You know, the middle of it, and then I was asked to come in and do guitars with Mick.
Ah,
because
okay.
Having a time getting a sound, so hung out with Mick doing that. And funny side story on that, we're doing it at Tommy's studio in his house, and go there every day and see Tommy and Pam all hanging out and stuff. And one day I pulled into the driveway and Tommy's on the phone and he is just yelling and screaming and throwing things and just so, oh, weird. So we went in and we started working and Tommy came and he's just in a foul mood. So he found out that his, I guess, longtime carpenter friend, whatever, you know, worked with him on this place or whatever for 3 years, had gotten in and stolen two of his safes out of his, you know, bedroom closet or whatever. Shit. And out of that was where those sex tapes were leaked.
Ah.
I remember that story. I remember when I'm hearing about the safe getting stolen. Wow.
Yeah. So I guess at that point it had just been stolen and maybe this guy was trying to ransom it back or something. And Tommy was just, fuck you.
But, man.
Yeah, so anyways, that's where we're doing the guitars. And then after we got a bunch of the guitars done, you know, I can't even remember how many songs, maybe four or five songs. Like, we're just doing little chunks at a time. And then I remember doing a bunch of vocals with John. Right. And, you know, he was awesome. He was, what a great singer he is. It's just, you know, sometimes a band has a nucleus of people that it doesn't work without that nucleus, you know, if you know what I mean.
Right.
And I think that's just what happened with John. I mean, he just did a killer job in that, but he wasn't, you know, the personification of Vince Neil, you know, and that's just what completes that thing. It's sort of like Aerosmith without Steven Tyler. Like, how do you do that?
Yeah.
In your opinion, do you think if Motley Crue would have changed the name of the band when John Corabi joined up, do you think they would have done better?
Not necessarily in those days. You know, maybe nowadays fans are a little bit more open to it. But, you know, basically everybody would say, well, that's just basically Motley Crue with a different singer, you know. And, you know, you build up such a name with your band that it helps grease the wheels to, you know, get bigger venues and sell more because of the name. And, you know, people can forgive that there's different members in the band. I mean, it worked when Bond died and Brian took over. So sometimes it works, but sometimes that nucleus is just disrupted too much that it's just not the same band. And I think if they called it something different, then, well, basically you just sort of go back and you got to start over again and kind of build that name.
Right. It's a damn shame, too, because that John Corabi Motley Crue stuff was awesome.
Yeah, it was. It was really good. He kicked ass, yeah.
Yeah, we love that record. We had a in-person interview with John at a bar in East Nashville just to talk about the making of that record, and we were there for 3 hours, and it was one of the most fun talks we've ever had.
Mm-hmm. Right on, yeah.
Yeah.
Never talk to him again. Tell him hi.
I will.
Seen or talked to him since we made the record, so...
Yeah, he's down here in Nashville also.
Oh, right on. Yeah. He did a good stint with the Dead Daisies for a while, didn't he?
Yeah. And then they got Glenn Hughes, and it sounds like a Glenn Hughes band. But anyway, not that I don't love Glenn Hughes.
Yeah, it's just any band Glenn Hughes is in becomes Glenn Hughes.
Right.
Yeah.
But with Aerosmith, to get back to them, like, so you did Permanent Vacation and then they came back with you guys with Pump. Was it a much different environment, or was it more just like, hey, the train's rolling, let's just keep doing what we did last time?
It was definitely the train's rolling, let's just do what we did last time. But it was a little bit different in that, you know, they had now done a whole tour on the road, newly sober. And they really got involved in like the 12-step program. So I remember everybody sort of having a counselor, I guess. So if there's a decision to be made, they'd kind of all go into separate area rooms, talk with their counselor, blah, blah, blah. Then they'd all come back as a team and form an opinion and then do that. And, I'm exaggerating just to give you an example, but it was very kind of a bit of a strange record. It wasn't as fun. I mean, it was definitely a great record to make, and we did a lot of really fun, cool stuff on it, but it started to feel a little bit more a heavier vibe around the whole thing than about Permanent Vacation. Permanent Vacation was kind of like your first day at grade 8, your first day in high school, you know, and now this is like your grade 10, and you think you're pretty cool, and... And you can beat up on the grade eighters, you know?
Yeah. Wasn't that when Tim Collins was managing them at the time? And like that, if you've ever read the Walk This Way biography, the relationship with him was a kind of a double-edged sword from what I remember reading, because, you know, he definitely helped get them back on track because they were falling apart before that he got involved. But then it became – I remember they said, Tim wanted to have a meeting about every single idea and every – you know, if you felt one way or another about it, you had to have a meeting or you had to go back into treatment. And I didn't know if there was drama with him being involved at that time.
That was probably what it was. I met – him a bunch of times and he seemed like a nice guy, but again, all that kind of management stuff is all behind the scenes to me. You know, when we're at the studio, Bruce didn't like any kind of heavy thing going on. I mean, sure, sometimes things happen, but you know, any those heavy meetings, okay, go down to the office or go to the hotel, whatever, and you guys talk at the studio's for creatives, studio's right. Got to be the free zone, no egos, no fights, you know, let's keep it clean. So, you know, you never you'd feel the background of it, but it would never actually be physically going on in the studio.
Right. Mm-hmm. There's something on your credits list that I'm trying to figure out because Aaron and I are both really into Poison, and it's got something called Not a Pretty Sight, but I don't know what that is.
Was that a live record?
Oh, it was. I thought that was called Swallow This Live.
Sure. I don't know. You know, most of the time when I work on stuff, it's, you know, sometimes even the songs aren't named. So rarely would the record get its name until I'm on to the next one. So, you know, that's why I have a hard time remembering what the record's called.
You know? Right.
So I'm not sure what that would be. And, you know, if that's on AllMusic, they mostly get it right. But sometimes I go on there and I'm like, what? I'm not an accordion player. That song. So I'm not sure what that is. I haven't looked up. Man.
That's wild. Yeah, man. Through your whole discography here, it's massive. You've worked with and on albums that have sold millions, and you've worked with bands that never really broke big. Was there ever anybody that you worked with that you thought, man, this is going to be huge, that just never went anywhere? Is there one that you're amazed that didn't make it more than the rest?
Well, there's two that I'm to this day amazed that never make it. First one was a thing called the Dan Reed Network.
Uh-huh.
He was out of Portland, Oregon. Bruce did the record, and it was amazing. It was like one of the funnest records I've worked on. You know, at one point, me and Dan stayed towards the end of the record, and back then, you know, extended the mixes. You know, if you have a 3 or 4 minute song, sometimes you could extend it to like 10 or 12 minutes. They're called dub mixes, you know, more for dance clubs and stuff.
Yeah.
So I think it was 3 or 4 songs we stayed and did club dance dub song, dub mixes of these things. And we worked for 6 days straight, no sleep, no drugs. I mean, caffeine and nicotine, and that was it. Straight through. And it got to the point that you get, like, you're not tired anymore. You're euphoric. And all of a sudden it's daylight out. The day staff is at the studio. And then next time you go up to the bathroom, it's dark and nobody's around. And it just turned into this weird, weird thing. So then we finally finished it. And we said, okay, well, let's just see how long we could stay up for. And I think I barely made the drive, an hour drive home in a nice, warm, sunny day. I barely got home, and I just crashed. And I thought I'd sleep for like 2 weeks, but, you know, 6 hours later, I was awake and feeling fine. So that was a great record. They're really, they were like funk rock, you know?
Right.
But I think they hit between a big crack where the funk fans thought it was too rock, and the rock fans thought it was too funk. And then, like, 6 or whatever months later, Living Color came out. There you go. So they had just missed it. But it was, you know, they had Derek Shulman, was one of the big A&R guys, signed them to this huge deal. They had, I lost his name now, big manager. San Francisco, died in a helicopter crash.
Bill Graham?
Yeah. Bill Graham was managing them. Bruce Fairburn produced a record. I mean, it was just, everything was lining up going click, 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 click. I think they got booked for an opening for the Rolling Stone or some big thing for the album launch. And just as the album came out, Derek Shulman changed job, moved positions, so another A&R guy came in and I guess, you know, decided, well, this isn't my record, so I'm just going to, you know, kind of shelve this and, you know, we'll do the next record kind of thing. Well, nothing ever came of it, but everybody I know that listened to that record just said, oh my God, I can't believe this didn't do anything, you know. So that was the Dan Reed Network.
What's the other one?
The other one was Blue Murder.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask you about that one.
Yeah, for sure. I agree.
That was a killer record.
Yes.
And, oh, yeah.
I really don't know what happened on that one, who dropped what ball. But, you know, to this day, there'll still be some, you know, bars I'll go to down the States and that still have the jukebox. And it's still, you know, you still hear these Blue Murder songs cranking out of the jukeboxes. And everybody's like, oh, man, that was my favorite record. I'm thinking, well, why didn't you go buy it then?
I will say I bought it for sure.
Yeah,
I love
me
that
too.
Record.
Both of them.
Yeah.
Oh, and there's, before I forget about it, there's, have you heard of a Swedish band called Eclipse?
You know what? I have heard of them. but I couldn't name you a song.
Well, there's a, and I'll send you a link when we get done. There's a song that they do. I can't remember the title right offhand, but they literally, it's a, it's more of an homage because the singer admitted in an interview, but the intro to the song, it's called Breakdown, mm-hmm. is the exact same intro to Jelly Roll.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he said he loved that record so much that he wanted to kind of give a tip of the hat to John Sykes with that.
Oh, killer. Killer. Yeah.
But yeah, like, I mean, John Sykes, Tony Franklin, and Carmine Appice. You can't get three better players than that.
Right. Oh, what a power trio, man. What a huge sound they had for three guys, you know?
So, yeah. John Sykes is such a mystery. Like, I mean, he's he doesn't do a lot of interviews. He's just kind of quiet. Like, did you stay in touch with him after those days?
For a while, we did another record. What was that? I think it was his son that was on the cover of Bad.
Nothing But Trouble?
Yeah.
Nothing
But Trouble, yeah. I only mixed that one. And we kind of stayed in touch, but we really sort of lost touch over the years. Probably a year or two ago, I think we reconnected through email, which, again, we didn't have back in those days. And I think he was putting together some new music, and we sort of went back and forth, and then just kind of stopped communicating again, you know. Just
right.
Sometimes life gets in the way or whatever. So I'm not sure what he's doing. I know I had reached out to him once before, too. There's a band I was working with, and I thought they could use some John Sykes songwriting help.
And, yeah.
He didn't really seem too eager to co-write things.
Yeah, he just sort of – he disappears off the grid for long periods of time. You know?
Yeah.
But he's so freaking talented. I love it. I love what he did with Tigers of Pantang and Thin Lizzy and Blue Murder. And obviously, you know, he did so much for Whitesnake that he never gets credit for.
Yeah.
You know, he's an amazing player and writer. I love that guy.
Yeah. Well, that's where I met him, was on the Whitesnake record.
Yeah. Well, you're listed on here for Children of the Night. Did you only work on that one song?
No, I did the whole record, but a guy named Mike Stone produced and engineered it. So that was right at sort of the tail end of my assisting years. So I was the assistant engineer on that record. So did the whole record with Mike and John. And then David came in to sing and lost his voice. And, you know, I guess just the wet, damp climate here in Canada or in Vancouver, he's just not into. So he went down to L.A. or Florida, I think, for a bit, and then ended up in L.A., and then Mike Stone and John and him had a falling out, so they ended up doing all the vocals and some more guitars with them.
Well, that record has a massive sound, too. I love that record.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that was Mike Stone, man. What an amazing guy he was. So he did a lot of the Queen records, his big kind of claim to fame. English guy. He was great.
That is cool.
So, You did a couple of great records with the Cult, with Sonic Temple and Ceremony. What was it like working with those guys?
Oh, man, I love those guys. You know, because Ian's Canadian, too, so him and I just really hit it off. And, you know, like so many of those great bands, especially back then, it seemed like it was a collision of personalities that really made the band, sort of, you know, Steven Tyler, Joe Perry, and you know, Billy Duffy and Ian, you know, because Ian was very much a sort of like more the underground, you know, alternative kind of thing, and Billy just wanted to be, you know, a guitar player in a massive, successful radio band kind of thing too.
Yeah, yeah.
And sort of the collision of those energies that create something really cool, because you know, one half, you know, Billy's pulling it one way and Ian's always pulling it back into the other way, and it just was cool. So it was really fun working on something like that. And especially when Button Heads was always a friendly way. Like, there's never any fights or yelling matches or anything. It was a friendly, like, you know, just try to get pull it into a different genre. And it was a great tug of war, and, you know, it was a fun record to do.
Yeah, I bet. It's like you say, it's perfect because, like, you got the one guy pulling one way, another guy pulling the other way, and where it lands in the middle is perfect for what they're doing at the time. And that must have been awesome with them too, because they're right, you know, when you start out with Ceremony, they're on their way up, and then Sonic Temple is the one that really does it for them.
Yeah, yep, exactly. And when we're recording Sonic Temple in here in Vancouver, I remember they did a song called The River, and it was basically a song about Vietnam. So it was really kind of vibey song, and I think it actually ended up being 8 or 10 minutes long. But when we went to track it, we were just all about, hey, we got to get the vibe right when we track this. And so we did it sort of late at night. And because we were at Little Mountain, you know, it was a jingle place, our main tracking room had a big, almost fit the whole wall, a big projector screen, so that when they were doing movie scores and all that, you know, they'd project the movie on there, etc. So we went out and rented Apocalypse Now, yeah. And we got about 200 candles and filled all the space and on top of gear, you know, the amps and stuff, all these candles, and lit that, killed all the lights, and had this movie on repeat, just the lights going while they tracked the song, and it was,
wow.
It was the most coolest vibe ever. Thinking in hindsight, nobody got a picture of that, or it wasn't recorded, it's just in my mind's eye. But, you know, that song never made the record, but I believe it came out in some package somewhere, though I've yet to hear it since we finished doing it and mixing it. So it's a song called The River, so I don't know if you guys can dig it up and find that, but boy, it was something special.
I wonder if that ended up on that Rare Cult CD that came out a couple of years ago.
It might have.
Might have, yeah.
I'll have to check into that. I know I got it.
There's one thing on your, and I know you only mixed it, but in 91 you did the South Gang Tainted Angel record.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good one.
And this is, I'm a fan of Butch Walker solo, but I love South Gang.
Yeah.
And Butch never wants to talk about South Gang because I guess he views it as cheesy or whatever. But I thought that band had a lot of promise, and obviously it came out in 91, and basically the parade was over by the time they showed up. But, I mean, what do you remember about making that record?
not a lot, to be honest.
Oh, really?
I remember the name. You know, sometimes, especially if I'm mixing, you don't really get...
You don't get to know them, yeah.
Set into it, like you just sit there and mix a song. Oh, that was cool. Hey, that was fun. You have your high fives, and then you move on. So, you know, we're looking at, is that 20 years ago? 30 years ago now? I don't know.
30.
Yeah. But definitely remember the guys, remember the name. They were from Georgia or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I've always had a thing for Southern rock bands. It's just, I just love it, you know, like Drive-By Truckers and all that kind of stuff. I just love the Southern rock thing. So,
yeah.
That South Gang's a good guitar album.
It is. Yeah.
Even though Butch will never talk about it, but they were a good band. It's just they were just too late to the game at that point, you know.
Yeah, well, that's when grunge was taken over or whatever, and it's just, you know, things just got a little bit different.
Well, I did want to ask about Coverdale Page, because I remember when this came out in 93, I was in high school, and it was because, like, that was in the middle of the grunge explosion, so it was all these newer bands doing depressed music, but I remember Coverdale Page came out, and that was a huge hit. Like, even amongst, you know, kids that were grunge kids, it kind of transcended what was big at the time. That must have been an honor to work on that record.
Oh, man, that was great, especially, you know, to work with Jimmy was kind of a dream come true. And then, you know, then he asked me to, like, co-produce it with him. And I'm like, oh, my God, you know, how am I supposed to tell, you know, my childhood hero? Jimmy, you're not playing that quite right. That's, you know,
wow.
there's a bit, like, if I was ever starstruck, which I never get with musicians, but it was close with Jimmy.
Yeah. Oh, man. I bet you do have a lot of stories about the making of that one.
Yeah, we had some good times, for sure.
Maybe that would be a good one to come back and talk about the making of, if you're up for it.
You know, Jimmy is, too. He's such a nice guy.
Yeah.
You know, a minute ago we were talking about South Gang and how the grunge thing came in and changed everything for bands like that. Did the change in the atmosphere of rock and roll in the early 90s, did that affect you at all?
Well, probably a little bit because, you know, just through default, you know, I guess, you know, Bruce, Bob and I had sort of, you know, been doing all the kind of 80s hair bands, you know, and that's, you know, whatever you've done last tends to be the next thing that somebody comes to ask you to do, right? So it put a bit of a hole in the schedule for a bit because also, like, it just died. It didn't sort of ebb away. It was like 1 second everybody's got their hair fluffed to 3 feet wide and makeup on to, you know, greasy hair and dirty jeans and t-shirts. And so it's a bit of an adjustment, but, you know, speaking for myself and I guess with Bob, it's like, you know, we just love doing music. It doesn't matter what genre it's in. It's like music is music, you know. Like, I've done a fair bit of country stuff and not classical in a sense, but, you know, more along those lines. I remember getting a phone call once to my management, and then they asked, well, does Mike know how to record a piano? It's like, well, we're engineers. Just because we do all this heavy music doesn't mean we can't record and appreciate other genres of music, you know. So, it changed the pace of music for sure. It changed how records were being done. Also, in the grunge thing, that was sort of more alternate music. So the budgets were really small. So that changed too. So no longer were the $500,000 budgets and taking, you know, 8 weeks to do a record. It's like, oh no, got to get in and out and do it in 2 weeks kind of thing. And, you know, so it changed a lot of things. You know, it's funny now in retrospect, you know, you get some of those old band Wasp and people are redoing some of the songs, and then you really realize what great songs they were, even if you didn't agree with that genre once it was out of favor. Then you listen to the songs and you go, yeah, but check the songs out. Like, they're awesome.
So many of those bands from that era that were still trying to come out with albums, even though they weren't selling, some of those albums, even though nobody's ever heard them, are some of the best stuff those bands ever did.
Yeah. And, you know, some of the remakes make it even cooler. But, you know, it's funny, once a certain genre goes out of favor with the majority of people, then everybody seems to stomp on it and say, oh, what? Oh, 80s? Oh, I hate that stuff. Well, you don't really. You just hate the idea of it not being cool anymore, but right. It's still great stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let me give a shout out to Richie and Scott from Focus on Metal, because they've done an amazing series on the Dio Strange Highways record, which I'm not even going to try to top. But you did a great job on that. And that album is so unsung, and it's a great part of his solo catalog. I have to imagine working with Ronnie James Dio must have been a lot of fun.
Oh, man. It was great. And, you know, he would kind of let us, like, you know, when me and Vinny, so Carmine's brother was a drummer on that. It's the first time I met Vinny, so that was great. And so he'd sort of let us kind of do our thing, and then he'd come in, you know, he'd be wandering in and out of the room, but, you know, he wasn't always there agonizing over everything. He kind of let us all do our thing, and then he'd come in and sing. So pretty easygoing guy. Like, you know, if he had something that was bugging him about a song, you know, he'd really dive in and become a bit of a bee in your bonnet. But generally a really great guy, and we remained pretty good friends for a number of years after we finished that record. So
that's great.
Really miss that guy.
If I were in your position, I would probably just sit for hours and listen to isolated vocals of Ronnie James Dio. what a voice.
That sounds like work to me, pal.
No, to you it does. Yeah.
Hey, I don't even have a radio in my house when I get up. I have no music on.
I get it. It's a job.
I love it, though, but yeah. No, I need some peace and quiet.
Aaron, are you going to ask about Jackal and Vince Neil? Because I know you love both of those.
Well, of course I'm going to ask about those bands, man. I love Jackal, but I'm really curious about the Vince Neil album, Carved in Stone, man. That album was far out, especially for Vince Neil.
Yeah, well, again, I don't know too much about that album, unfortunately, because I only mixed it. But I remember it being being great. I went down to L.A. to mix it. And, you know, Vince and I are pretty good friends. He's crazy. But it was just cool that he, you know, he was kind of doing his own thing and sort of breaking out of the Motley thing for a bit, because it just always seemed like he was just, okay, you know, Vince, you just go up there and sing and we'll do the rest of it kind of thing. And so it was just neat to see him going out. I remember really liking a lot of the tunes in that record. But during while we're mixing, it was some crazy rainstorms in LA, where the river, or the, you know, the canal or whatever it is now, flooded, and there's actually people dying and falling into this thing. Damn. And Vince has a place out in Malibu. Well, there's a slide and a flood and all that. Anyways, he was basically stranded on his property, and there's a few of his neighbors, and they had to send helicopters in to get them out of there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's crazy. He didn't, you know, we were supposed to come in and approve a mix and didn't show up, and I couldn't get him on the phone and whatever. It was later on that night or whatever. He's, Fraze, hi. You wouldn't believe what happened to me. He says, only to me.
That's wild, okay. Yeah. That album was so weird. It was so different from anything that he had done in Motley Crue, but it was really cool for what it was and unique as hell.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's, again, I like when guys can kind of break from their normal day job and thing and then show their creativity, because, you know, it wouldn't be something that would have flown. Like, you know, I know a lot of bands that, you know, there's the one or two main writers, but the other guys write too. It's just not songs that fit the band, so then they sort of get pushed down kind of thing. So it's just nice when they have an opportunity to be able to break out and do the record. Whether it does well or not is beside the point. You just gotta sometimes get that creativity out of you, you know.
Yeah. And We're gonna go to some listener questions if you have some extra time in a minute. I do wanna touch on AC/DC because you've worked on several records of theirs, and some of the listener questions involve AC/DC. But I got a follow up on you in the interview with the Australian guy. He asked you, and I'm gonna press you also. There was rumors that AC/DC had gone back into recording in Vancouver like a year ago with Brian. Is there anything you can share on that? Like, is there a record coming? Do you know anything?
I think we've got a bad line here. No, you know what? I can't say anything about that.
Well, so I'm going to take that as a yes.
Yeah. Well, if you do happen to see him, you just let him know we're ready for a new album, if whenever they are, just let us know.
Yes,
that's funny.
I had to ask. I'm sorry, but I had
that's
to.
Okay.
So, Aaron, you want to go to some listener questions?
Yeah, because there's some really, really awesome questions in here that people have asked, and these are really good. I guess I'll start right at the top. Stephen Kirsch. Now, he sounds like he might be a little biased, but he's wondering, do you have any great stories about Thunder, one of the greatest bands that never broke in America? Is there currently a better singer than Danny Bowes?
Man, those guys, well, remain and still are very good friends to this day, but went over there to work on their first record, Backstreet Symphony, and with Andy Taylor producing. So we went out to this big manor house out in the middle of nowhere and sort of camped out there. And what a time we had. You know, not only was the music great, the playing was great, but we'd stop for dinner. You know, we had a chef in the manor house that would cook us dinner, you know, just basic dinners. And then after dinner, we'd sort of have a little bit of a quiet time. It was during the summer. And then so these guys started teaching me how to play cricket. So we'd have a cricket match out the grounds of this manor house. We'd have an hour or so playing cricket and getting some exercise and back in and working. And then because we're so far away from towns and, you know, you can't really drink and drive, so we started our own pub in the basement of this manor house that, you know, during the week, well, it was just us, you know, guys in the band and the studio, the people. But then on the weekends, they'd get all these people up from London. I think it was a 2 or 3 hour drive from London. So then weekends would just kick off there, and we just had so much fun. And I think that ends up getting on the record. That record sounds like it's a lot of fun. And answering the Danny question, you know, Danny has got such a great voice. I mean, he's still got it, too. You know, all these years later, he's still got that pure tone to his voice, his notes. And, you know, yeah, there's no better singer than Danny.
Yeah, he's awesome for sure. All right. Al Horta, he says, you worked on mixes for a few Rush Live DVDs. Was it difficult to mix a band like Rush because their music is so dense? And what do you think of the music of Rush?
Well, Rush was one of my first musical crushes back when I was still in high school. Nice. I remember going out and seeing them in their early years. Like, they were one of the hardest working Canadian bands ever. Mm-hmm. They would play, they'd come across Canada playing every little place they could get into, and then they'd tour all the way, hitting all the places all the way back to the East Coast again. Any time of the year, they're an awesome band. So I've been a huge Rush fan for years. And mixing them was a thrill. You know, I've been so blessed in my time to been able to work with probably most of my sort of childhood heroes, and them being one of them. I don't find them difficult to mix. I mean, they're a three-piece, so, you know, everything's sort of got its place. You know, I mean, for sure, when things get dense and fast and different time signatures, there can be complications to mixing it, but I wouldn't say difficult, and especially when you're into the music, you just kind of get into this trance and go with it. So, no, it was always a blast working with them.
That's cool. I got to imagine, like you said, you know, it's got to be an extra thrill for you when you are a pre-fan of the band you're about to be working with. What's it like when you've got to mix an album of music that you just don't understand?
Well, it does make it a little bit harder, but again, it's my approach to music is like, you know, when I get a song to mix, and especially if I haven't heard it before, I ask them to sort of send a rough mix of it or whatever. And I sit and listen to that for about half an hour, and then I pull up all the tracks really quickly onto the board, and then again have a listen. And, you know, you try and find what is the soul of this song. Like, you know, like you said earlier, like, you know, is it vocals? Is it based in these riffs? Is it that? And you try and figure that out. And then it just, again, I do kind of go into a bit of a trance, and, you know, I don't overthink things. I just kind of react to what, oh, that's cool, and that's cool. And, you know, every once in a while when I send the reference mix off to the band for them to check out, they'll say, oh, that guitar part, oh, that shouldn't be that loud. We're not even sure we're using that. It should be this. So sometimes I totally miss the vibe on it. But, like, if I hear something cool, I'm like, oh, I love that. And, oh, that works great with the bass. And the vocals sit great on that. And sometimes you miss it. But, you just get into the music, and every genre of music's great. So, you know, even if it's not one of my personal favorites, I can still get into it. When I'm working with band, like, you know, even with the Aerosmiths and that, like, my favorite songs are usually the songs that end up on side B, and I rarely like the singles. Yeah. Until the singles get played on the radio a lot, and then I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, I get why everybody likes that. But while we're doing it, I like the sort of quirkier, deeper cuts than the obvious singles, personally.
Right on. One of us.
I can dig right on.
Yeah, well, back when we used to buy vinyl, you know, I'd get a new record of my favorite band, like, you know, really anticipating to hear it. And I'd throw on side two first. I wouldn't even listen to side until that was set.
Amen.
I hear you, brother. That's cool.
Or 45s. Remember 45s? You get the single?
Yes.
I'd always flip it over. It was like the side B of the 45. Because it was never even on a record or anything. That was the only time you got that song. And there's some that you're going, what the hell? And some were like, wow, this is awesome.
Yeah.
That's deep awesome. Tracks are always the best.
Yeah, man.
All right, here's a good one from Dare In. It goes, let's see, he says, what was working with Rick Rubin like for Ball Breaker, and was there talk on trying to achieve the classic dry sound from the Vanda Young-produced albums of the 70s?
Well, that one was an interesting record. I know when I got the call to work on that record, and they were saying that Rick Rubin was producing it, I thought, oh, this is great, because, you know, Rick sort of had a period there that was the sound he was going for, was AC/DC, and I thought, oh, this is going to be a perfect match. But we got into it. The studio was picked in New York. It was a place called the Power Station, and it's known for big ambient drum sounds, and their main ambient room was this big round room, and somehow that's where they got booked in to record this record. So we spent 6 weeks there trying to deal with this ambience and taking the ambience out and making it dead. You know, we had a circus tent we brought in and put the drums behind, baffles. We took this whole room, and I've got to say it's probably about sort of a 30-foot-high dome kind of room. Every surface in that, we put burlap sacks on it, anything to try and make it dead, and nothing worked. Mm-hmm. And I guess because they had prepaid the studio bill, the studio wouldn't let them out of it, so we had to sit there for 6 weeks trying to get a sound happen.
Oh, my God.
And then during that time, you know, me and the band, we'd show up at, you know, 11 o'clock, noon, and then Rick would show up about 8 or 9 at night. It just got a little bit tense, so finally we packed it all in and moved to L.A., moved it all back to L.A., and started over again. So it was a difficult record to make. And Rick is quite – he's a great guy, really good producer, but it didn't really gel with the AC/DC guys, I have to say. You know, he's a very hands-off producer, and the band want a hands-on producer. You know, like, you know, when Rick would show up till night, I'd say to the guys, you know, at some point in the afternoon, I'd say, well, look, why don't you guys just bash down a few versions and you know, play it for Rick when he gets in? They said, nope, he's the producer. He needs to be here while we're playing. So it's just
that makes sense.
Yeah.
It didn't really work. So, unfortunately.
Wow. Here's something interesting. Darren's also asking this one. I've never heard this, but apparently it's a myth or a legend. Is it also true that Angus had to record the riff for Thunderstruck with just one string on the guitar?
No, not true at all.
I never heard that one before.
I haven't heard that one either.
Yeah. Maybe two strings. No.
Oh, that song, the sound of that song is so incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fun.
Here's a really good one from Chris Jackson. Can you talk about the movie, the instrumental track at the end of Aerosmith's Permanent Vacation with all the trippy effects on it? It's one of the weirdest songs to ever appear on a big hit album, and I'd love to hear the story behind it.
Oh, well, I'm just trying to think of what was on the end of that. Like, we put so many weird little sound effecty things on both those records. I'd have to go back and listen to the song and see.
Well, to be continued.
You're trying to tell me you didn't sit down and listen to your full discography before we sat down here today?
I tried.
Oh, man.
Well, we did get, you know, orca whales in there and all sorts of things. So.
Yeah, that is weird. He also wonders, has there ever been a situation where the drummer wanted his drums mixed higher, then the bassist wanted more bass, etc.? I always think of, like, Ronnie James Dio and Tony Iommi alternating, telling the mixer what to do.
That's every band.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine, another producer friend of mine, we call it the band, taking the band around the block. So, you know, they come in and, oh, the drummer wants a little more drums. Oh, a little more bass from the bass player. The guitar players, they go, the guitars are getting a little buried. Vocalists, I can't hear the vocals. So you like, all right, guys, you know, we're going to do this, and it's just all going to keep coming up. No, then you got to do it and all the way. And then you do all this stuff, and it just turns into a freaking mess. And then somebody listens and goes, you know what? I like the first mix better. It's like, but sometimes you got to take them all around the block to get back to where you were and say, okay, can we move on now?
That's awesome. Well,
my limited recording experience is a band that went nowhere, but I will attest to that. Even unsigned bands that have nowhere to go will also do the same thing to the guy mixing the album.
Well, you know what's funny to me, and, you know, probably because I'm you know, experienced in this now, but every single person, when they want a change done, they want something up.
Yes.
Turn that up. Can you turn that up?
Yeah.
Okay, can I get the bass and drums up, guitars up a touch, and then a little bit more vocal kind of thing? And I go, well, how about if we just turn everything down a bit? Well, you can't do that. I'm like, yeah, I can't. Watch that.
Wow. Yeah. That's it.
So yeah. But everybody always think, oh, I want more of that, more of that. They don't know. Think I want a little bit less of that.
Yeah, you never hear a guitar player saying, you know, you need to really bring me down in
right.
the mix.
Well, he'll be quick to say, bring the bass and drums down a bit.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Turn off that vocalist.
Too funny. Eric Spinks got a good one. First, he says, thank you for your contributions to many of my favorite albums. That's an impressive list of credits. I'm guessing that it's a very different experience to work on a live performance concert movie. What stages of the productions are you normally involved with, and how does it differ from your studio work?
Well, live, you kind of get one shot to do it on maybe a little over half of sort of the live records I've mixed, I've got to record. And for me, that makes it a little easier because I kind of know what I'm wanting to capture, and then I can tweak it in the mix. You know, sometimes you get something from somebody else and they'll paint you a little bit into the corner, so it's a little bit harder to get it to gel. But for me, funny enough, some of the most important tracks to record when you're doing live is the audience. You want to get some really good audience sounds, and it's really hard, especially the bigger live outdoor shows, because when the PA is so loud, you get more PA in the thing than the audience, because you can't get the mics down close to the crowd because, you know, they're spitting in them and doing whatever. And then also the outdoor shows, you get all the wind noises, and then you know, so many cables go bad and get crackles. But, you know, it's really important to get a good audience sound, especially for the sort of the more modern, when you mix a live record now, you're doing a DVD, so you're doing it surround. Well, audience is where you could really get the surround going. I mean, you know, when you're watching a live band, you don't want the bass coming out from the rear left speaker and a kick drum from the rear left speaker. You know, you want to see the and hear the band at the stage, but you want this audience surround, so it's really important to get the audience mics together.
It's very interesting. Let's see. Jamie Roberts says, which band did you have the funnest experience with, and which one was the biggest pain to work with?
Well, I've had a lot of the funnest experience. You know, again, the Dan Reed one, we had such a blast doing it. We're just sort of like, felt like, what was that, the Peter Pan thing, you know, all the little pirate kids or whatever. It's sort of like what we were. And that was fun. The Blue Murder record was really fun. There was a lot of debauchery going on that record. And, you know, I've been really lucky. I haven't really had any pain in the asses, you know. And especially with the bigger band, the bigger they are, the nicer they are. You know, there might have been a few sort of young, upcoming bands that come in with a real chip on their shoulder and they're just little assholes, but I can't remember any of them, to be honest. I've been quite blessed and lucky to have been able to work with some really great people.
I suppose at that point, you know, these guys are professionals and it's time to get down to business.
Well, you know, studios, you know, are expensive, so, you know, you don't want to get in there and start. Yeah, you know, like I said, everybody just tends to leave your ego at the door. Let's get this done, and then you can be the jerk you want out in public or wherever. But, you know, we're all trying to do the same thing for you. We're trying to get the best we can and not use up as much as your money. So, you know, come on, let's get this done kind of thing.
Right on. Got a good question here from our awesome friend Henning in Germany. He says, any behind-the-scenes stories on the mixing of the Bad English debut would be great. And also, he loves Blue Murder and the Dan Reed Network. And he wonders about the differences between working with Richie Zito versus Bruce Fairbairn.
Ah, right. Okay. Well, the Bad English, I just remember, I think I did two records for them. The first one was just especially awesome. I don't know what happened. You know, the band sent me the tracks. I'd never heard of the band. I do know Richie produced that record. And just the tracks were just great. And it just all came together. I remember these guys coming in and you know, they're some pretty good, you know, famous musicians and that would come in and they're just like blown away and say, oh my God, this is the best thing ever. And they're like, oh, no comments kind of thing. So I remember that impressed me on that because it's like, you know, usually I'll do my thing and somebody wants, you know, can we, you know, brighten the guitars up or can we, you know, there's always little changes. So there's not very many changes on that when the band would come in and listen. You know, as far as working with Bruce and Richie, you know, it was very different situations. Richie and I never sat and did a record together. It was more mixing stage. So we were very good friends, and actually we ended up being on the same management. So we'd have a few dinners and lunches and that, and we're very good friends. Didn't work together that often, but, you know, very talented guy, and it's always great when you work with a producer that is a great artist in his own right. So, you know, he really gets the artist's perspective too. So that makes it a little bit easier for the communication with some musicians where you can speak as a fellow artist as opposed to, you know, me sort of trying to explain chords with my fingers in the air, you know?
All right. Sure, you can trust what's being brought to you.
That's right.
Right on. Grayson Gallegos has got a good one. He says, Mike, you've worked with heavy metal, punk, rock, and pop bands and artists. What do you do to keep your ears and mind fresh for all these different genres and bands?
Well, when I leave the studio, I don't put on any music. I used to put sort of my radio on in the car. I don't even do that anymore unless it's on a talk radio thing. Or sometimes I'll put on like a completely different, like a classical station or something. So, you know, I just get, because I get my head so far into it, I just got to get it out of it. And there's some music I like listening to just for pleasure, but it's really hard for me because next thing you know, you're going deep into the thing and you're listening to the kick and snare and like, yeah. Oh, yeah. Why is that doing that? And it's, oh, right. I used to like this song.
Yeah.
So it's like hard to get out of work mode.
It's like a reflex.
Yeah.
Is there a little bit of nervousness about, you know, like subliminally being influenced by something else when you're working on what you're working on?
No, because I don't even remember the stuff.
Right on. Like when I got then, you. I just
but the task at hand, you know, and you know, for sure, I don't want to copy things, but I don't worry about that.
Yeah. Let's see. Keith Rockford says, with all the bands you've worked with, which created the most challenging, talking about getting tracks recorded or even written, and who did you enjoy working with the most?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, sometimes some of the younger bands are quite challenging, and I've found, especially later on in my career now, that, you know, you get them into the studio and they get what we call red light fever. And then these guys are, I can't believe I'm in here with Mike Frey, and they get sort of embarrassed or starstruck or something, and they can't do their thing. Like, what's it, dude? I'm the normal guy. I put on my pants, just play your guitar like you did on those demos, or like I saw you play live. And yeah, but we're here at the warehouse studio, and oh, I can't believe we're here. It's like, well, believe it, and let's have some fun. And you know, and I don't condone, you know, drinking and drugging while we're working. But sometimes I say, look, dude, let's just, you know, get a case of beer. And, like, you guys got to settle down and let's get this done. It's supposed to be fun. And when the music's fun, then it shows up on tape. So, you know, those are the more challenging ones, you know, especially with the younger singers. And, oh, they lost their voice. And it's just nerves. And it's like, oh. Get rid of your nerves. You've got nothing to be nervous about unless you piss me off. And fun bands, I mean, you know, almost every band I've worked with has been the most fun I've ever had. You know, again, the Blue Murder, Dan Reed, Thunder Guys was a lot of fun. The Jackal Guys was fun. I've had a pretty fun 40 plus years of it.
Well, for and sure. you've done so much with AC/DC. I have to imagine they're fun to work with too, right?
They're great guys because they're blue collar, down to earth guys, and you would never know that they're worth multiple millions and stuff.
Right.
They just pulled me into their little family. You know, when we're working together, I'm just like family. I guess that's why I keep getting the call back. A lot of their road crew is, you know, from day one. So they like surrounding themselves with family, and that's the feel, you know. The last few records, Angus's wife Ella has cooked us dinner in the studio, so it's like, you know, we'll be working. I'll say, okay, dinner time. Okay. We'd all come to the table. No, so how was your day today? And, you know, it's just like being in a family. It's awesome.
That's awesome. Super cool. Hey, speaking of AC/DC, Alex Gale's got a good question. He says, how have you got AC/DC's guitar sound so crisp and bright on the last two albums?
All the records I've done with those guys, the process has been the same. There's basically, for Mal Sound, there's one main head and one main guitar. And for Angus, there's probably two heads. And he's got his main guitar, but sometimes he'll use one of them for leads and one for different kind of tunings that he's in. But it's pretty easy. Shortest guitar cable from guitar to head, shortest speaker lead from head to cabinet, and that's their sound.
Wow.
It's just, you know, one or two mics. It's Malcolm's one guitar on one side, Angus one on the other side. There's no doubling. It's just pure. The mesh of their two sounds together make it sound like it's huge. And, you know, I find as soon as you double it, you know, initially you go, oh, wow, that's huge. But now both the double and the guitar have to sit back a bit more because together they're louder, right? So
right. There's
less impact. So, you know, if you can get a good sound and have one guitar, that's where the sound comes from.
I truly enjoyed Rocker Bust. I love the sound of that record.
Hmm. Sweet.
All right. You only got a couple left. Odorous wants to know, what's Axl Rose like in person? Is he just as egotistical as he is on stage and in public?
Well, you know, I've never physically met Axl.
Oh.
I did a Guns N' Roses live mix, which was a bit of a thing to piece together because, you know, as a live band, they're more about vibe than what they're playing. So mm-hmm. You know, we'd have shows from all over the world, and we had a crew of people piecing them together. So, you know, we'd have drums for one show and guitars for another show because we didn't want to bring the guys in and replay anything. We wanted it all to kind of be live. So try to make that all work. So we got most of the songs done, and I think there was three or four songs that the vocal just couldn't get anything together on the vocal. So we needed to get Axl to come in and sing on it. So called up his people and, you know, they arranged something. They said, oh, yeah, well, he'll be down there at 10 o'clock tonight. I'm like, oh, okay, great. So I usually start at 10 and finish at 10. But I thought, okay, well, that's cool. I'll finish what I'm doing. We'll do a couple hours with Axl. Awesome. So 10, 11, 12 shows up, 1 a.m., nothing.
I can't believe it.
Pulling his people. Oh, yeah, well, I got stuck into tomorrow night for sure. So then I'd phone, you know, start phoning at 8 o'clock and say, are we good for midnight? It's probably going to be closer to the 1, realistically. I'm like, all right. So we did that for 3 or 4 days. And then I said, okay, you know what? I'm done. You have Axl sing these vocals when he can do it. I've done everything I can do here. I'm going back home to Vancouver. And that was kind of the end of that.
Yeah.
So I've heard he's a really nice guy, but I have never seen him in person. And I don't appreciate people being that flaky. You know, I get it once or twice that, oh, shoot, sorry, I got stuck. Something came up. But
right.
4 days straight, nah, right. That's close. So, that's disrespect.
So reading the tea leaves, if AC/DC recently worked on a record, Axl was not there because you were there, correct?
I don't know who was there and who's not there.
Oh, come on.
Detective Sinzak on the case.
I'm trying.
Yeah. Reel that one in.
All right. Let me leash my co-host here for a second. Andrew Jacobs has got one. He says, you did a lot of the mixing on my favorite Corrosion of Conformity album, Wise Blood. What was that experience like?
That was awesome. I think that was shortly on the tails of mixing the Load or maybe Reload, because Pepper and the boys were big fans and friends of the Metallica. They had just finished that record, and they said, oh, we need someone to mix this. And James or somebody had said, oh, I got to check out Mike Fraser. So we hooked up in New York at Electric Lady, and that was the first time, and I think the only time I worked there. And oh, what a great studio. So that was Jimi Hendrix did a lot of the stuff, and right. Just great, cool vibe. Those guys are really awesome. John Custer was producer, had some great vibey stories about, he had gone to Italy and then bribed a security guard to be able to get into the big pyramid, or not Italy, sorry, Egypt, and got into the big pyramid and spent a night in one of the chambers inside the big pyramid. Like, great stories. That was a fun record to do. And while we're doing it, we'd sort of had the nighttime shift there, so we'd go, I think we started at 10 p.m. and we'd go till 6 in the morning or something. But there's some nights, one of the guys would come running and say, okay, I hear something going downstairs. And no, you can't. We're the only ones in the building. We go down there, nobody down. And you come back up the top of the stairs and you could hear this cat meowing or whatever. So we talked to the staff the next day, and there's, famous cat, ghost here. That's Jimmy's cat. Jimmy's cat still here.
What?
So it was pretty cool.
Oh, wow. That's a legendary place for sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Legendary band, too. Love those guys.
Yeah.
Well, before we wrap up, we haven't touched on Metallica yet. What did you think about working with Metallica?
Oh, man. Loved it. That was more Bob Rock and Randy Staub did a lot of their stuff. Then when they started doing sort of the Load records, they were the band, and I guess they all wanted to do it as a double album, but the way the band and I guess them wanted to mix this record was spend time on it. So they're doing a song every 5 or 6 days, and usually when you mix it, you do a song a day kind of thing. Well, to do 25 songs, 5 or 6 days a song was just going to take too long. So that's where they hired me to come in, and Randy was mixing in one studio, and I was across the street in another studio, and they're basically twin studios, same gear and stuff. And so we each mixed half the record. And by the time we got Load done and, everybody, management, everybody's saying, look, we just can't do a lot of double record. This is just going to take too long. So they stopped at Load, did their tour, all that. Then we came back and did basically Reload. And I think on Reload, they recorded a few more songs. And then we did the same thing, mixed it again. But I thought it really tough spending 5 or 6 days a song. One day you'd spend drums only. All you'd have is the drum tracks, and they're still doing edits on the bass. And then the second day, oh, great, we got the bass now. So it's just, I'm more of a organic, I need to get into the vibe. I need to hear everything and how's that working. So,
yeah.
It's hard to do, but fun, great guys. A lot of people say Lars is a bit of a dick to work with, and I didn't find that at all. He knows what he wants, and he expects you to get it. So that's being a dick. I don't think so. It's just personally, you do your better than your best.
I think Toby Wright said about the same thing, but he said it still took them 3 weeks to get drum tracks for And Justice for All.
Yeah. Well, it's because he cares,
Right.
Yeah, he wanted to piece apart every little drum. He cares about every single, note being struck on his drums.
Yeah, exactly. I'd rather that than somebody go, oh, that's good enough.
Yeah.
Can you just deal with it? Can you fix it? I'm like, okay.
Were you a fan of Metallica before the Load and Reload albums?
Well, I really liked the Black album. I'm not really sort of the heavy speed whatever metal kind of stuff. I like Iron Maiden. Never got hugely into them. That kind of stuff. So that part of metal was heavier than what I was ever into or exposed to. But I love the aggression of it, and when it's done well, I love it. But I didn't know it well. For sure.
The reason I was asking is because, the Load and Reload albums were so much different than what Metallica fans had gotten used to over the years. I was wondering how your reaction was to it, that it wasn't your typical, just straightforward rock and metal Metallica.
Yeah. They seem to like to experiment, their experiment with Bob turned out really good. And then they go and make Saint Anger, and everybody blames Bob and that, but it's the band trying to reinvent and do something different but stay in the same vein. It's not an easy thing to do, and they're probably similar, though I've never recorded with Metallica, but they're probably similar as AC/DC, where AC/DC does and records songs they want to do. They're not told, hey, we need another hit, we need this, we need, like, they just do what they want to do, and if they want to do songs they like doing and hope the fans like it too. And so, Metallica is probably the same kind of thing. Like they got to where they are by not listening to everybody else. They did what they wanted to do. So
that's true.
Sometimes you do what you wanted to do in a certain moment in time and your fans go, oh, what the hell did you do? Oh, you lost. Well, we did what we wanted to do. Sorry you don't like it,
Right. All right, I've got one, and I've decided I'm going to ask every single guest this for the rest of the show's eternity.
Okay.
Do you have a funny Ace Frehley story?
Oh, wow. No.
No. Well, I had to ask.
Yeah, I never worked with that. So I don't know. Sorry, Ace.
And then we got one more. Oh, this is an interesting one. It comes from Garth Richardson.
Oh, great.
He wants to know, what's the best plug-in when mixing a drink?
Well, my secret is you've got to keep the alcohol in the freezer. Your mixes have to be cold in the fridge, and then a big giant glass of ice. So you fill that about half full of your alcohol, splash it off with whatever mix you're using, and you've got the perfect drink.
I love the fact that you had an answer ready to go for that.
Well, I'm thinking about looking at one of those right about now.
Words of wisdom from a master mixologist.
I'm guessing you know Garth pretty well.
Yeah. We've done a few things together.
That's hilarious.
That's awesome. Man, this has been a lot of fun. You got some great stories, man.
Oh, thanks, man. It's been a pleasure coming on, and we should definitely do this again.
Yeah, we want to break down a whole record with you for our Albums Unleashed series, and I'm tempted to say either Coverdale Page or Blue Murder. What do you think?
Either or, give me some heads up, and then I'll do a little research on them so I can even remember the songs.
Yeah.
But sure, yeah, anything.
For sure.
Awesome.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.